Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. All right. Next case we have on calendar today is docket number 64289, Godfrey versus, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that, Azagdum.
That's close.
Is it close? All right. All right, Mr. Gilmore, are you ready?
Yes.
All right.
If I could reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
Good afternoon. Joshua Gilmore of Bailey Kennedy on behalf of the appellant Haile Selassie Godfrey, or Haile for short. My client is before this court today to seek review of an order entered in the district court which finally establishes child custody and child support concerning three minor children. We have presented three issues for this court to consider on appeal today. They are as follows. One, whether the district court abused its discretion in deciding child custody. Two, whether the district court infringed on my client's constitutional rights in establishing the party's visitation schedule. And three, whether the district court abused its discretion in calculating child support. I'll take the issues up in that order, unless this court would like me to focus on something in particular. If this court finds that the district court abused its discretion in deciding child custody, it would render moot the second and third issue that we've raised. Beginning with child custody, we start with NRS 125-480, which outlines those factors that a district court shall consider in deciding what is in the best interest of the child. And in that case, the district court must fairly consider the evidence presented for each factor in deciding what is in the best interest of the child.
What's our standard of review in that situation?
Abuse of discretion. And so here, when you have two fit parents, each parent must be treated equally in the analysis. So in effect, both parents are the plaintiff, and each is putting on evidence related to the factors under NRS 125-480 to show why he or she is entitled to custody of the minor children.
What are the specific areas you want to draw this court's attention to?
I would like this court to focus specifically on the findings that we see at Volume 3, pages 654 to 55 of the record. That relates to the findings of fact and the conclusions of law that the district court made, both concerning 125-480, subsection 4C, which is which parent is more likely to foster the relationship between the children and the other parent, and also 125-480, subsection 4E, which is whether these parents can cooperate with each other to meet the needs of the children. And what we see at page 654 and going into 655 are irreconcilable findings, findings that don't fit together and cause this court to be unable to come to the conclusion that this custody arrangement was reached for the right and appropriate results. And why do I say that? Because on the one hand, the district court here says the plaintiff, Marath, is more likely than Haile to encourage the children to have a relationship with the other parent. And in the same breath, on the very same page of this district court's findings, it finds she is trying to limit the children's time with the children unless dictated by her and using them as pawns to advance her own interests. The district court could make one of those findings or the other, but to make them both, you can't explain and understand how the district court could find both for and against Marath and still decide that she should be awarded primary physical custody. The other thing I would point out relates...
Isn't that finding more so a Hobson's choice in this particular case?
It can be, Your Honor. And why I mentioned...
On the contentiousness of the parties during the hearings before the court.
To say the least, it was a contentious proceeding. But when you look at 125-480-4 and the various factors, even if we say under 480-484C, Marath is more likely than Haile to encourage the children to have a relationship with the other parent, 480-484E, she's not cooperating to meet the needs of the children. So we go back to how do we treat...
But is that absolute or is just one of the things the court has to consider as it goes through and works through that?
You are right. The court has to consider all of that. But when you're dealing with two fit parents and each is putting on their burden, in effect you have a scale. And both sides are putting on their case to show why he or she is entitled to custody with the children. It's a wash here at the end of the day, because if 484C favors Moraff, then 484E favors Hiley. The only other thing we know that played into this district court's analysis is the work schedule. And that might even be more confusing than what I'm talking about now. Why do I say that? We had two parents who were going to be working on Saturday. Great. One, unavailable during the day. One, maybe unavailable at night. That shouldn't work against either, in theory. But that's not what happened here. My client's work schedule is held against him. Moraff is commended for working on Saturday, hoping to work on Saturday. That shouldn't happen if you have two fit parents who are being treated equally in this analysis.
Was there any indication in the record, was there any evidence proffered that his work schedule would affect the well-being of the children when they were in his care?
No, just evidence as to what...
Just a statement that was a factor considered was his work schedule, and there was nothing offered.
Just evidence as to what are you working each week. We don't dispute that the district court had the right to consider that. But our argument is if you're going to consider it, you've got to consider it for both parents, and you have to treat them the same. Let me move on to the second issue, unless this court has any other questions as to the child custody analysis. In terms of the visitation schedule, what we see from this October 9, 2012 transcript, which is at volume 6, pages 1081 to 1135, is extensive discourse between these parties about going to church on Sunday morning with these children. And the result of that hearing from October 9, 2012, is actually mentioned in the findings of fact and conclusions of law made by the district court after the two-day hearing. You see that at volume 3, page 650. What we see at that October 9, 2012 hearing are two parents asking to take their children to their church on Sunday morning. Very important to both of them.
Clarification for the record, because going back through it, at first I was of the impression that it was the same church. And then the record got kind of vague as to whether or not it was the same church that both parents wanted to take the child to.
Arguably vague at first, but that is fleshed out. Ultimately, they are different churches, Your Honor. That we can see for certain at volume 8, page 1565, where my client highly testified that they go to different churches. During the October 9 hearing, there was an initial suggestion that they went to the same church, and Moraff testified, no, that's not true.
Was it the request that they split that visitation so they alternated on the weekends or opportunities during the year so that both parents could afford this issue as religion, or were both parents demanding that they exclusively had the right?
The transcript would suggest the latter, Your Honor, that both parents are saying they want to take the children to church on Sunday morning.
So they both put themselves in a position that one would lose and one would win, opposed to a compromise.
You could read that way, Your Honor. That's correct.
That's the only way I can read it. That's why I'm asking.
I agree with that. Now, ultimately, what we did see...
If you don't get your wish, then you should then contest it. If he had won, would he now be contesting?
I can't speak to what he would be doing. I imagine he would be satisfied if he had been given the right to take the children to church on Sunday morning. What we do see from this record was his counsel asking to have the children for his 10:45 service. And since he had an 8:30 service and hers began at 9, fair reading that would give them both an opportunity to take the children to church on Sunday. Based on that transcript and reading through the record, a casual inspection of it points out an issue of constitutional dimension. Does this visitation schedule, which at first glance...
And that's kind of a secondary thing as a curiosity. In your review of this area and family law, do we have any case authority on the national scene about this particular area of religious freedom?
We have a lot of case law on that area, Your Honor. The two cases that I thought were the most close in point were the Neely versus Neely case and the Sanborn v. Sanborn case, where we actually focused on a visitation schedule in particular. A lot of cases you find are one parent saying, I don't want the other parent to talk about his or her religious faiths at all with the child. You see that more often, a motion to enjoin the parent from speaking about his or her religion. But we found and identified those cases where you're dealing with visitation schedules, that have the effect of keeping one parent from taking his or her child or children to church on Sunday morning, one of the most basic ways to exercise the freedom of religion.
But we have this issue as to whose freedom of religion is it, number one, and then, but more importantly, the measuring stick that Nevada uses, that is, what is the best interest of the child?
I agree with that. And the cases say that when there is no showing of a clear and affirmative showing of harm to the child, then it is in the child's best interest to be exposed to both parents' religious beliefs because it puts the child in a position later in life to know which religion that he or she wants
to pursue. So from your standpoint, is it rational to have one parent hand off the child after the 8:30 service to go to the 10:30 service with the other parent? Or would it be better to have an alternating weekend situations? Or what do you think?
I think that's ultimately for the parents to decide.
It's in the courts. The court's going to have to decide. If the parents could decide it, it wouldn't be here.
If the court is to decide it, then every other week seems the most prudent result. Any other questions on this subject? Or, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'm curious, was there any talk about the joint physical custody instead of primary physical custody? Joint legal custody.
Correct.
Was there talk about joint physical custody?
My client
50-50?
My client sought joint physical custody, as we identified in the brief, from day one, an equal timeshare arrangement. We saw that's what he was focusing on. And so here, we submit that that should have been the result that the district court reached, that these parties were awarded joint physical custody alongside joint legal custody.
One last question. There was an issue about willful unemployment, and I know there was a job separation. I don't know if that was temporary or what that was about.
I'd be happy to speak to that, Your Honor. 125B.080 identifies three things that the custodial parent has to show in order to have the district court impute income to the non-custodial parent: underemployment, willfulness associated with such underemployment, and willful underemployment to evade or avoid paying child support. All we have here is underemployment. As a practical matter, somebody that's not even earning minimum wage, to infer that he's doing that on purpose is a stretch. All we had here was Mr. Godify may be underemployed. We see this isn't an individual who was making a lot of money at the start of the case, and by the time we got to the hearing, he was making nothing. In fact, in his first financial disclosure form, he wasn't making any money. We see that at Volume 1, pages 160 to 66. So because we didn't have willful underemployment, and that's been the law in Nevada even predating the enactment of the statute. So the statute is enacted in 1987. 1970, in the Rosenbaum case, this court spoke to when you would impute income to the non-custodial parent. And it used this language: if that parent is, quote, intentionally holds a job below his reasonable level of skill, or purposefully earns less than his reasonable capabilities permit. So I'm focusing on intentionally and purposefully. The statute ended up doing that using willfully. Ultimately, it can't be could earning more money. It has to be should earning more money. Anybody could theoretically earn more money. There's got to be more to it than that. We didn't have any evidence of that here.
Any other questions?
No.
Okay, counsel, because of the questions that we were asked to chew into your rebuttal time, so I'm going to give you two additional minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I will do the same for Mr. Black.
Well, let me ask at least my $64,000 question here. Why isn't it abuse of discretion by Judge Pollack to not grant joint physical custody in this case? Well, what's the issue that we should not have joint physical custody, these two parties?
Make sure that I understand your question. You're asking why is it an abuse of discretion?
Why isn't it abuse of discretion?
Well, it's not an abuse of discretion, first and foremost, because nobody was asking for joint physical custody.
He just said that he was.
I disagree with my opponent because over and over and over again throughout these proceedings, Dad, the appellant, requested primary physical custody and only in the alternative, or at sometimes he verbalized it as in the minimum, did he want joint physical custody. But if we look at the record at AA-29, which is his answer and counterclaim, AA-552, which is his amended pretrial memo just before trial, AA-1636, which is his trial testimony, and then AA-1684, which is his counsel's closing argument. On all of these occasions, he's emphasized that he wants primary physical custody and that joint physical custody, if it appears, appears only as an alternative request for relief. My opponent in his reply brief does indicate that the opening statement of the evidentiary proceedings that Dad's counsel did request joint physical custody and equal timeshare. That's the only place that I'm aware that that request appears.
Why shouldn't have Judge Pollack granted joint physical custody as a compromise? What about this case? What's so different about this case as to these mother and father, these children?
Well, Judge Pollack analyzed the best interest factors and then also analyzed the work schedule, which he found to be significant, and I can address that in some more detail if necessary. But I don't know that this case is different from so many others. I think that the prevailing obligation of the trial court is to make an order that is in the children's best interest. And I think on a whole, Judge Pollack did exactly that. The conflict between these parties was such that an order for joint physical custody simply would not be practical. And as a whole, Judge Pollack did find in his findings of fact and conclusions of law that that was the case, that on a whole, this case was not appropriate for a joint physical custody timeshare. And when you look at the factors in particular, my opponent did focus a little bit on which parent would foster and encourage the relationship with the other parent. And all of this comes down to really fundamentally, when you get down to it, it comes to abuse of discretion. All of these issues do, because they focus on facts received by the trial court. And when we look at what was actually received, the evidence that was presented during the evidentiary proceedings, we do not see Dad indicating any acknowledgement of Mom's high points as a parent. In fact, he says that she doesn't have any high points as a parent. She has no redeeming qualities. Nowhere in the record does he indicate that it's important for the children to have a good relationship with Mom. These are all things that Mom did say affirmatively in her testimony. Mom affirmatively said that she gets the children excited about the visits with Dad. She talks about what they're going to wear. She only says positive things. She even starts talking about the visits the day before. We don't hear anything like that from Dad. All we hear are this list of horrors of things that, the various ways which he believes that Mom is neglecting the children or not caring for them. And when you look at these things on a whole, I mean, even witchcraft was introduced in this case. That's not an exaggeration. That's actually there. But when you look at it as a whole, if we believe everything that Dad says, how could the court possibly award joint physical custody to these parties?
Let me ask you this. Going back to, you say this is an abuse of discretion case, and there was a finding that was made as to Dad's work schedule being a significant factor here, and I'm trying to see in the record where that's supported by any substantial evidence that it would be against the best interests of the children to award custody in the, because of his work schedule.
Well, I think that the work schedule was addressed last after the obligatory 480 factors were analyzed. And the testimony from Dad himself was that he works 5 days per week at a minimum of 4 to 5 hours, beginning at 4 and then ending no earlier than 8 or 9 o'clock. And typically, he's working a swing shift, which would be from 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. So he's got 12-hour shifts, and the court found that the majority of the hours that the children would be home, Dad would be unavailable. And I believe the court framed it as a practical consideration Dad's unavailability is on its face is evident.
Now, let me ask you this. There was also, did the court inquire into other child care arrangements? There was an indication in the motion to reconsider that he has an adult daughter who would be willing to provide care, and did he consider mom's work schedule as well?
Well, on the first...
And she apparently was going to become a hairdresser, and so she would be working as well. So it seems a little inconsistent to me and somewhat unfair that you consider one side and not the other side, and then not explain why the work schedule affects the best interests of the children.
Well, Dad presented no evidence at trial as to any alternative child care arrangements. And so that was not something that the trial court was apprised of in any way.
Does the court have a duty to consider that on both sides, though, and determine whether or not make some inquiry as to whether arrangements can be made? I'm sure it's an issue in just about every case.
And absolutely. And again, as a whole, the court's got to look at the children's best interests, and it has broad discretion to do that. We know that. And so when this court looked at the available work schedules, the issue of mom's work schedule really wasn't relevant, because if you look at the trial testimony where that issue appears, mom also testifies that her proposed visitation schedule for dad were on the days that she anticipated working. Remember, she didn't have this job. This is a job dad had. This was a prospective job, and she had suggested that dad's days with the children, his visitation, be from Thursday at 6 p.m. until Saturday at 6 p.m., which would encompass the Friday and Saturday that she'd be working. And so it was never anticipated that those days the children would be attended by any third party. And certainly when you've got two fit parents, as my opponent points out, I believe that a parent should take precedence over any third party. There's no evidence and presented anywhere that mom was
unavailable. Well, there was also some testimony, from what I recall or understand, maybe I'm mistaken, that dad's testimony was that his work schedule was inconsistent. It wasn't consistently 4 to 4 or 5 days a week. There were other times that he'd work 3 days a week from 4 to 9 p.m.
Dad testified that his work schedule did vary, and that he worked 5 days a week for a minimum of 4 to 5 hours. So that always began at 4 p.m. The children would be home from school at or before that time. And so, again, we've got at least until 8 or 9 o'clock, well after the children are likely in bed, that dad would be working. Most of the time that the children are home, dad's unavailable. And he did indicate that usually he works 36 hours, but he also indicated that the week prior that he worked about 40 hours. And so, the schedule does vary, and obviously as a taxi driver that's going to happen. But we do know that he's got a minimum of a 5-day commitment on the days that the trial court indicated, and that we are going to be going from late afternoon to early evening, well into the evening, probably longer. And the trial court determined that as a practical matter, dad's unavailability, together with mom's availability, was relevant, and that was a factor, not necessarily the determinative factor, but it was a factor in his consideration.
How did they come up with the visitation? What's the basis of the visitation? The time frame.
Dad's visitation corresponds with his stated days off.
I'm hoping that I'm looking at the right order. It's defendant shall visitation on a weekly basis commencing on Sunday at noon and concluding on Tuesday at 3. Am I wrong? Am I reading something wrong?
That sounds correct. I believe it's Sunday through Tuesday.
So it's 51 hours for him and 117 hours for her.
That sounds accurate.
I'm just going to say, what's the basis? You said that's his days off?
Yes.
Even though he has
maximized the available time that parent had to care for his children. I mean, that's certainly, again, not the sole consideration, but a relevant consideration. And please keep in mind that in the alternative, if dad's not available, we'd be relying on a third-party caregiver over and above an available and fit parent. And I don't know that that's...
Commonly, in a lot of families today, both parents work for a living. And so you have caregivers, whether they're family members or other individuals. But let me turn your attention to the other factor, and that was the argument that was raised as to some type of religious accommodation. What is your position as to that?
Well, the argument that dad's right to participate in the religious upbringing of his children was infringed upon because Sunday mornings are not part of his visitation schedule fails for multiple reasons, and not the least of which is the fact that it was never raised at the trial court level. Even on the October 9th, 2012 hearing, the dad never affirmatively said that there were not any other services available. There was a question as to whether the parties attended the same church. There was no evidence presented anywhere that the parties are of different religions. That's important because religious beliefs isn't just contingent on the attendance at a specific church. If the church is part of the same denomination, then that would be a factor that would not be irrelevant. But we got to keep in mind that in the 8 months from October 9th, 2012, the only place that issue appears, and the first evidentiary hearing, dad did nothing. He didn't mention it. He didn't seek reconsideration. He didn't file a motion to modify the timeshare. And he took absolutely no action whatsoever. And as you're aware, we believe that that's clearly a waiver. You cannot bring something up for the first time on appeal that you've not argued at the trial court level. And I think the plain error argument fails because the record is not sufficiently developed. We don't even know that the religious considerations are invoked here, that there are any fundamental rights that can be infringed on, and there's clearly no adequate basis for a review because there is no testimony or evidence presented on the issue.
The record seems to reflect that there was nothing, as you were saying, at the initial temporary stage, but there was discussion as to which parent should take the children to church. Is that a fair reading, or is that inaccurate?
Are you able to point out where in the record that appears?
No, it was a general flavor that there was discussion as to which parent should take the child to church.
That's not something that I recall explicitly. What I do know is that dad's pastor actually testified, and not a single question about the church service times or of, you know, anything that would shed some light and give this court a record to review and consider this issue was presented. The fact that dad goes to church seemed to be the focus of that testimony. And again, if something was so important to dad that it merits a constitutional consideration for the first time by this court, one would think that it would have been raised prior to now.
Well, the court sua sponte can consider constitutional issues.
Of course it can. Number one, we don't have on its face a presentation of a constitutional issue before the court. And I'm not at all questioning the court's ability to do that. But I'm also saying that the issue of invited error is relevant here because if this was such a focus for dad, clearly the omission must have been deliberate. Otherwise, it would have been mentioned at some point in those intervening 8 months. And then again, there was another, a month after the first evidentiary proceeding, there was another opportunity for dad to bring it up, and he didn't.
Let me ask you one more question as to the court's consideration of relationships with other siblings. And I think it was indicated in the pretrial memo that dad's adult daughter was refused visitation with the children by mom. And I don't see that the court specifically considered that factor about sibling relationship.
And Justice Bergeri, I don't know that issue was specifically litigated at the evidentiary hearing. There were a lot of things that were addressed in filings that were never ultimately presented as evidence before the court. And I will offer that the issue of whether dad's daughter from a different relationship was around, present, whether they resided together was a disputed issue throughout the case that ultimately was not resolved at the evidentiary hearing. And so, again, based upon that record, I do not believe that the district court was in a position to examine that factor as regards dad's other daughter.
What if he files a motion to at least be able to take the children to church once a month? Are you going to defend against it? You going to say no?
I mean, that's speculating makes me a little uncomfortable in these, at this point. I guess it would depend on a variety of things, and it's not before me.
It just seems unreasonable to me that he never gets to take the kids to church. That's unreasonable to me. And even if we affirm, you may see in a concurring opinion by Justice Jerry saying, you know what? I don't like when people are so firm in their feelings that they it's unfair to the other party.
Well, you heard my opponent mention that the other party wasn't very concerned about mom being able to take the children to her church either. But first and foremost, I just don't see how the trial court can even consider this without having the information in front of it. And a mention in passing that was ambiguous at best 8 months prior to the evidentiary proceedings is not enough to put the court on notice that needs to be something to rule on. And in his motion for reconsideration, he doesn't even address the church issue.
My footnote in my concurrence would be that I understand who had the better attorney in this case. There's no doubt in my mind who had the better attorney.
On the appellate level or on the trial level?
Both. Both. Because it's a concurring opinion, not a dissenting opinion. But we'll see. We have to conference on this. I don't know how my colleagues are on this. I don't even know how I am on this thing, because I don't know how to really feel about this issue, about the church thing. I just think it could be worked out, especially with the provision, and maybe this is just a tip. The parties may agree to any additional time with the children or changes in the parenting schedule by mutual agreement. Any agreement to alter the parenting schedule shall be in writing signed by both parties. That'd be a good start, maybe, to let them go to church.
I'm not sure if there isn't something close to that that's already in the findings that they could agree to other accommodations.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm reading from.
Oh, okay.
I'm reading that from the decree, saying maybe that's a tip-off.
Also, if they could agree, they wouldn't be here.
I can't argue with that.
I have nothing further.
Anything else?
No. Okay, thank you for your arguments.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr.
As you're coming forward, there were a lot of things that we got into preliminary discussion about, and the other side has asserted those representations weren't made down below. Would you like to walk us back through that and tell us why he was wrong or why we should consider them if they weren't raised previously?
As to the church concerns, Your Honor? Correct. And let me go through that October 9, 2012 transcript, because I disagree it barely
came. As well as representation about the daughter being willing to aid
in assisting watching the children. And that's true, and Your Honor hit this on the head. Two parents today both work. You can't hold that against one parent if he's working and not hold it against the other parent. There's no evidence in the record about the arrangements that Marath is going to make when she's working from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday. So again, if we look and say, well, Hailey, what are you going to do if you get called out to work on Saturday night? How are you going to watch the children? Nothing about it, but nothing about what Marath is going to do. So if we're going to infer that accommodations can't be made for him, you got to make that same inference because, again, we're talking about two fit parents to be treated equally in the analysis. We don't have that here.
Is this church issue a real issue, or is it just something that's been put up here for litigation purposes?
It is a real issue, Your Honor, and Justice Cherry, you asked what happens if later on he raises that. You know what we'll see? Claim preclusion. You should have brought it up the first time.
Let's relate back. Was it raised? Counsel said it wasn't raised below.
It wasn't raised at the evidentiary hearing, Your Honor. That is correct. It is raised at the October 9, 2012 hearing where they were discussing the visitation schedule. And ultimately, the district court references that in its final decision. So we know the district court looked back to see what happened at that October 9th hearing. And if the district court's doing that, and when we have such a serious issue as to two parents both saying, I want to take the kids to church on Sunday, and we know the law encourages that and says we've got to let that happen. If you get those claims from competing parents, then you have to do something about it. And unless there's a showing of harm to the child, which we don't have here. We don't have that. Without that showing, it's in the children's best interest to go to both churches because, again, that positions them later in life to decide which faith to pursue. And it also, of course, secondarily, because we're focusing on the children, but it also withholds and sustains both parents' fundamental rights to exercise freedom of religion. One of the most controversial but important areas that we see today, how important religion is to everyone. And so to not allow that to happen here, I submit as an error of constitutional
law. If the judge had awarded visitation rights starting at 9 o'clock on Sunday instead of noon on Sunday and ended them at noon on Tuesday instead of 3 o'clock on Tuesday, she wouldn't have been able to take the kids to church.
Correct, and I think that went back to Justice Douglas's earlier question as to what would happen if the roles were reversed. And I can't speak to her, but I think you'd have the same issue even if the roles were reversed.
Well, the issue, the reason I'm saying that it may not be claim preclusion because the claim isn't firm until he, till Pollack makes a decision on the visitation rights. Then it becomes an issue. It didn't become an issue because he could have been at 9 o'clock on Sunday instead of 12 o'clock on Sunday.
Correct. I can't say for sure they'd argue that. But I think the history and what we see from this record, a very contentious, a lot of pretrial motions. Unfortunately, these two don't get along. But I want to point out perhaps the most important finding that this district court made for this court to consider. This is at page 653. Both parties have a good relationship with the minor children. Both parties. Ultimately, we have two parents fighting with each other, not affecting the kids. Kids get along great with both parents. And like you said, Justice Sherry, why is one parent getting so little time compared to the other parent when in the end they're just fighting with each other? We have so much inconsistency as to how these parents work with each other, but we ultimately see a great relationship with the children. My time is up. Any other questions?
All right, any other questions?
One final question. If you had to write the order for the court, how would you write it?
As to all three issues, Your Honor? I would submit that this decision should be reversed and remanded with instructions for the district court to enter an order awarding joint physical custody. As a result, the visitation schedule will need to be modified to reflect that. And then as a result of that, we know under Nevada law, when you have joint physical custodians, child support is calculated differently.
What about the argument that it really wasn't requested? All he ever wanted was primary custody.
Your Honor, I pulled the opening statement because we know when you go to trial, ultimately, what are you there to ask for? That's what matters. And I pulled the opening statement from his counsel. This is at pages 1177 to 1178 at volume 7.
Right. It was alleged that being the
said,
alternative.
With that, well, here's what she says, his counsel. The children are his primary focus, and he's seeking joint custody. That's what she says. We believe that he meets the standard under NRS 480 that the factors will play in his interest for joint, if not even primary. So I don't dispute that he asked for both. But we got to look and see, what are you asking for? When it push comes to shove, we're at that hearing. His attorney is saying joint custody, and she ends it with, all he wants is to be a part of their lives and share equal time with the children as any good father would want to do. Why is that? We got to look back to the beginning. Remember, for the first 6 months, we have supervised visitation at Donna's house, a man that saw his children every day. And then for 6 months, it was while somebody was watching over you before he got an overnight visit. He went into this fighting for time for his children. We see that from this record. This man broke down during the hearing. We see that in the record as well. This is a man fighting for time with his children, and we ask the district court reverse and remand so that he is awarded joint physical custody.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? No? Okay. Counsel, I thank both of you for your arguments today. They were very fine arguments, and these are always tough cases. The briefing was very good, and we appreciate that greatly. So this matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until 1:30.